And so the festival, they always want to bring a rabbi, because he said to me, a lot of these people will never have seen or spoken to a rabbi in their entire lives. So he's concerned about the impression that a rabbi makes. And what was interesting was after the debate, which was on Shabbos morning, they got me a hotel that was close to the place. And so, I mean, they were all aware of whatever. So afterwards, I'm walking back, after the lunch, I'm walking back to the auditorium when three or four guys in kippot grab me and say, come join us for Mincha. Uh-huh. And sure enough, there were like 10 or 11 Orthodox Jewish young men who had come to the festival and were staying, they were probably staying in the same hotel, were staying nearby. And so we did Mincha, and then we had Sudash Lishi, and we learned some stuff together, and it was quite remarkable there in Puebla, Mexico. And there is no synagogue in Puebla. There's no real Jewish community, but they all came from Mexico City. Now it's about 2 million. Before the earthquake, it was apparently much, much smaller. But a lot of people left Mexico City for Puebla, which apparently also has earthquakes, but not yet. Anyway, the festival itself was really, there were some wonderful talks. And by the way, LA was well represented. Jared Diamond was there from UCLA. Jonah Lehrer, the neuroscientist who's spoken here at the synagogue, gave a wonderful, really wonderful talk. Young guy whose new book, he's like 29 years old, his new book is on creativity. He's already written 2 books. He writes for Wired and The New Yorker and so on. Really, really good guy. And Michio Kaku, whom some of you know, gave a talk about the future. Also, he was involved in our debate, which I'll talk about in just a second, but he gave a talk about how you're going to have contact lenses that will have the internet on it, and you'll be able to access the internet, and you'll be able to see, and someone's information will come up when you meet them, so you won't forget their name. And I came up to him at the lunch. I was talking to him for a while, and I said to him, you know, I'm not sure that I want the internet on my contact lenses. And he said, you may not, but your children will. Oh. And I said, you're probably right about that. And then I said, actually, you know, it would be very useful for sermons. And you know, he said, every profession finds its own use. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could just look out and you would think, you know, ah, he's got all this in his head, when in fact it's all in the contact lens. So I don't know, maybe it would be. And he talked about other, you know, medical things and other things that were quite remarkable, including, and I had actually seen an article about this, the fact that they've already in Germany devised the beginnings of what in Harry Potter is called an invisibility cloak, where they somehow neutralize the light waves so that if you put that over this tape recorder here, you actually won't be able to see it. And who's most interested in invisibility cloaks? I'll give you 2 guesses. The military. The military is investing tremendous amount of money to be able to be destructive without being seen. So that Kaku's talk was a very interesting talk. Daniel Schachter, who is a Harvard professor and an expert on memory, gave a talk about how much of our memory is constructed. That you think you remember things, but in fact, they implant false memories very easily in people. They take them into a laboratory, they give them 9 real memories and a 10th one that's false. 80% of the people they do that with remember the false memory. The other 20%, he said, who say they don't remember it, if you call them the next day, they'll remember it. Oh, I didn't remember it in the lab, but now I remember it. He said, and our memory is stored in different parts of our brains, so we construct it from different pieces, and his talk was called Future Memory. He said, because the reason we construct it that way is because our memories enable us to act in the future. And that which enables us to act in the future isn't always a taped transcript of what happened in the past. We build what we need. And so he gave one horrible and telling example of a memory expert, a colleague of his, who was arrested for rape because he was identified by looks and by name by a woman who was raped. And he proved that he was actually on television doing a live broadcast at the time of the rape. And with sufficient investigation, they discovered that the woman was watching him on TV. Oh, yeah. And she substituted his face and description for the person who had raped her. And he said, even though this is a particularly dramatic example, it's not an unusual one. Wow. He said, people do this all the time. They have much more faith in their memories than they should. At least that's what I remember him saying. So it all of a sudden occurred to me, there I am giving you a transcript of his talk. For all I know, you'll go on the web, you'll listen to him, it'll be completely different from everything I said. But it was really an interesting talk. And I sat next to, I'll give you just one more. I sat next to this guy, Henry Markram. Very soft-spoken, elegant, interesting man. His wife is also a neuroscientist. She told me she started out in philosophy, but the scientists kept getting there first. So she switched over to science. He's building, he's the head of an international team in Lausanne, Switzerland, that is building a computer model from the ground up of the brain. So that they will understand the brain infinitely better, and after he's done, he's going to start building computer models of animal brains. So that they'll understand how whales think, how dolphins think, and so on. So I'm talking to him, and sure enough, so where else have you worked? Well, I spent 12 years in Israel at Weizmann, and I thought, you know, it's wherever you go. So he was a fascinating guy. And then we had the debate, and the debate was, you can see it either today or tomorrow, they're going to put it on the web, not dubbed in Spanish. Right now it's on the web, but it's dubbed in Spanish. And I have to tell you what a bizarre thing it is to hear me speaking Spanish in a woman's voice. But it's true. But because I remember what I said. I don't know which. They had earphones, just like at the UN, with simultaneous translation for all the speakers in both English and Spanish, depending on which. They were doing it. It was very impressive, actually, when you think about it, because most of the speeches were, I mean, she didn't have them in advance. And there was a lot of, obviously, there were a lot of technical terms, because there were all these scientists, and one nice, actually, I just want to mention one very nice, Steven Pinker, who is one of maybe the world's leading science writers, just finished a book on violence, showing that actually there's a decline of violence throughout history, even though we think that there's an increase, the 20th century proportionally is less violent than the Middle Ages, proportionally less violent than ancient times. Anyway, but he's a very distinguished professor from Harvard. He's written a lot of books. He's famous internationally. And there was this band that was playing. They had music in between several of them. And all these kids, there were a lot of kids there. They got up and started dancing, and they came by and grabbed him. And sure enough, he danced all around the auditorium. It was so nice to see, and they were all taking pictures of him. And I thought, you know, his non-insistence on his dignity will be very memorable to them. It was really, it was nice. I did not dance. So I just want to make clear, right, who's actually a flexible personality and who isn't. So the debate was essentially, they said, there was Richard Dawkins, who, even though he's a brilliant guy and his book on religion is was a bestseller and I didn't think he showed at his best in this debate. He did more ridicule than he did argument. And there was Michael Shermer, whose basic argument was, here are all the other ways you can create purpose in your life. You don't have to think the universe has purpose in order for you to have purpose. The universe is random, and you should be loving and kind and so on and so forth. And even if there wasn't a God, you would be loving and kind. And in fact, I don't think that the people over there would be mean if there was no God, pointing to us. And then there was Matt Ridley, Matt Ridley is a science writer from England. Wonderful guy. I liked him very, very much. He writes for the Wall Street Journal now. He just started a column for the Wall Street Journal. And he, I thought, was the most effective because his essential argument was that just because you don't understand something is no reason to ascribe it to God. So you don't understand whether the universe has a purpose, but just to make the leap that it has a purpose, or you don't understand how the universe developed, but just because you don't understand how it developed, just because there's a mystery to it, is no reason to assume that God... And you can, by the way, see, I wrote an article about this. It's now on the Huffington Post, on the religion site, which gives a brief review. And already there are lots and lots of comments from people. And for some strange reason, the people who go on the Huffington religion site and write are always anti-religion. Everything I've written on there that's gotten comments, like 98 out of 100 are anti-religious. It's a very interesting phenomenon. I don't know why that is, but anyway. Yeah, the article is posted, the comments are posted, and the debate was posted in Spanish and will be today or tomorrow, they told me, or I think today, in English. So you can see the video. It's like an hour and a half.
The topic of the purpose of the universe?
Yes. Does the universe have a purpose? Not what is the purpose, but does the universe have a purpose? And we argued yes. Obviously, one of William Lane Craig argued that
if there's a God, there's a purpose. If there's no God, there's no purpose. And then he gave eight or nine quick reasons why he thought God was the best explanation of the world. And then I talked about something somewhat similar. I talked more about the idea that the universe is so intricately balanced. You know, if one tiny cosmological constant were different, there would be nothing. So you have to ask yourself, you know, how do you account for the fact that we exist? And I made a couple of other things about intangibility, and then the third guy spoke similarly about the idea of God. I thought everybody was really quite good, and it was an interesting debate. I won't give you too much more about it, but as I said, you can see it or read about it. It was a great conference. It was a fascinating thing to be part of.
Read about it in your contact lens.
Right, exactly. You can read about it in your contact lens, sure.
Were you the only rabbi?
I was the only rabbi. Last year, they had Shmuley Boteach, who was part of a debate. But they were unhappy because the reason is that he was in a debate. Actually, I had heard about this with one of my debates with Hitchens. Hitchens had been there last year, and Hitchens told me about this. That's when I first heard about this Mexican. And he told me about a fight that he and Shmuley had had. It's true. The problem was he did two things that they were upset with. One was that he argued that evolution was mathematically impossible, given the time frame of the world. And remember that all these guys who he debated with, Daniel Dennett and others, that's what they do. They're evolutionary biologists. They're not going to listen to a rabbi about whether evolution is possible or not. So they were dismissive and contemptuous of that line of argument. And the other thing was he argued that without God, there's no reason for morality, and that's how you get a Hitler and a Stalin. And they felt like that was way below the belt. And so actually beforehand, Andreas Roemer, who was the head of the thing, said to me, he said to me, you know, you're the only rabbi most of these people are ever going to see. I really hope you do us proud. That's essentially what he said, because he had a lot at stake. Look, he's a very self-identified Jew. It's his festival. And he liked Shmuley very much, he said, but that made him, it was uncomfortable to have people feel like he was saying, you know, if you don't believe as I do, then you get Stalin and Hitler. And also remember that Mexico is a Catholic country. And even though there are things I very much admire about the Catholic faith, their attitude towards Jews is not one of them. So although it's changed a lot in years, and also it's a strange mixture of socially very conservative and very not conservative. So that was by the way an interesting discussion too about that I had with the Mexican Orthodox boys about Orthodoxy, Reform, conservative. They don't know a world apart from Orthodoxy. So why do I believe what I believe? What do I think about different social issues and so on? It was good. It was really very good. So anyway, all right.
Thanks for sharing.
What's that?
Thanks for sharing.
Oh sure, it was a great experience. It really was a great experience. And even in the casual, Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web, spoke there, and Chris Anderson, who's the CEO of Wired magazine, spoke there. I sat next to this woman at lunch, Elizabeth Pisani, who's a health expert and works with AIDS worldwide. There was a woman there who was an expert on twins, Nancy Siegel. It was a great variety of people who spoke about really tremendously different issues. Sean Stevenson, who's this remarkable guy, wrote about him in the column, he worked in the Clinton White House. He's less than 3 feet tall. He was not given any chance of surviving. He's in a wheelchair. He has all sorts of physical disabilities. And he wrote a book called Get Off Your Butt, B-U-T, right? About why people use excuses not to do things, and basically look at him. So in the middle of the debate, at the end of the debate, they took one or two questions from the audience, and he raised his hand, so of course they brought the microphone over to him. And he said, you're so arrogant. And I thought, oh no, what's he gonna, he's gonna schmeiß, which means he's gonna smear our team. Because I had no idea how he stood on this. He said, I can't believe you're so arrogant as to think that something as puny as a human being can have a purpose, and the universe, which is infinitely greater than us, couldn't have a purpose. And I thought, yay, Shauna. And you know, actually, when I was leaving, as I told you, he spoke while I was with the Orthodox guys and doing Sudashli Sheikh, which was my first obligation. Now, when they say, join us for Mincha, I can't say, no, I have to go listen to a lecture. You have to go to Mincha. That's, you know. And so as I was leaving, he said to me, I can't believe it. I got your back and you didn't come to my lecture. I said to him, I promise I'll listen to it online. But and I wrote about him in the article, which I hope you'll see. So there was really, it was just, and I just want to mention one other fascinating character, Amir Axel, who is at BU. He's a mathematician. He's written books on Einstein and Fermat's Last Theorem. He wrote an account of how that was finally solved. And so grew up in Israel and wrote a book on Kabbalah that I'm going to order and read. And he sat at our kosher table with his wife and his daughter, who it was the only other vegetarian there. I mean, maybe not in the conference, but at least in the speakers' dinners, they kept like scrambling to try to find us, you know, a mushroom. And I detest mushrooms, but that's a. But I was sitting between him and Jerome Friedman was on the other side. Jerome Friedman is a Nobel Prize winning physicist from MIT. He's in his early 80s, grew up a poor Jewish boy in Chicago. And so I said to him, what's it like to win the Nobel Prize? I mean, you know, he said, really, we grew up, sometimes we didn't have enough to eat. He said, and it was the most elaborate, fanciest, most amazing thing. He said, like the crystal on my setting cost more, you know, than anything that we made in a year growing up in Chicago. He said, the only reason I could go to college was because I got a full scholarship. He said, otherwise I wouldn't have gone. And he said, but the thing about the Nobel Prize is that you have to constantly remind yourself that you don't know anything more the day after you win the Nobel Prize than you won the day before. He said, because everybody asks your opinion about everything, as though you know everything in the world. He says, it doesn't matter whether it's peace in the Middle East, or your own field of physics, or somebody else's field of science. He says, once you win the Nobel Prize, it's like they sprinkle holy water on you. That's what he said. And the thing was, this was interesting, and I actually think that this was partly intentional. So I spoke to him beforehand about the... he was one of four respondents. One was a child prodigy violinist who was about 14 that they responded. The other was Kaku, Michio Kaku, who said the universe might have purpose. It depends how you define purpose. If you see it in an Einstein grand way, yes. If you see it in a biblical monotheism way, I don't think so. He said, but neither side can be sure. Then there was Amir Axel, the BU guy who talked about symmetry and how he didn't know how you got this symmetry, and it certainly could suggest purpose. And then there was Jerome Friedman and Daniel Schachter. Daniel Schachter was the memory guy. He said he's more interested in why we think the way we do than both sides, than what the answer is, because that's how... But I was worried about Jerome Friedman, because beforehand, he and I had a long conversation, and I gave him this, isn't the world balanced on a very... fine tuning, you know, and if the one of the little constants were different, it would plunge into darkness. And he said, well, it depends. He said, there are some physicists who hold that, but I actually think that there are other ways of explaining it with the multi-universe and so on. And he gave me all sorts of mathematical constants that I pretended to understand when I was talking to him, but I had no idea what he was talking about. It was like he could have been talking Greek as far as, but I nodded and smiled. And at the end of it, he said, you know, you're the most rational rabbi I've ever met. So, you know, I will take that from a Nobel Prize winner to my grave. That's it. Yes, he's very smart. He's frighteningly smart. I actually asked him who the smartest people were that he ever met. I'll tell you in a second. And so I was worried when he got up at the debate that he was going to essentially dismiss my point, but he didn't at all. He talked about something separate and different when I asked him afterwards. He didn't quite say it in these words, but I think what he said to me was that he has tremendous fidelity as a Jew, even though he doesn't feel himself a believer. And I think he did not want to get up and be seen as somebody whose public position was, I'm not with them. It's just, you know, Jews are interesting. So people are, it's that Yiddish phrase, you know, Jews are like other people, only more so. So I said to him, okay, you've met all these brilliant minds. Who are the most brilliant minds that you've met? And he talked about Murray Gell-Mann, who's a famous physicist. And he studied, he said, but the most brilliant minds I ever met were, he was a student of Enrico Fermi's. He said, who's one of the great physicists of the 20th century, who said it was a remarkable mind, a remarkable genius, and also incredibly focused. That he really, he said, he didn't allow anything to distract him from his. And he said, and the other person was Richard Feynman. He said, the thing about Feynman was, and Feynman was the one, I don't know if you remember from the Challenger, first of all, his books are witty and wonderful, but also from the Challenger, he's the one who figured out what happened with the Challenger disaster by taking an O-ring and dropping it into liquid nitrogen and showing how it immediately would freeze and you could break it, right? Which is what happened with the Challenger disaster. No one knew what happened. Feynman figured it out. So he said, the thing about Feynman is, he said, with a genius like Murray Gell-Mann, who's a physicist at Stanford, famous, brilliant physicist, he said, it's like his mind works like yours, but to the nth power. He said, but everyone I knew who knew Feynman thought, I can't understand how his mind works. And that's unlike anyone that I ever knew, which was just an interesting thing to think of, you know, just to hear from somebody whose mind obviously works differently from all of ours. Anyway, so yeah, it was a great conference. I really enjoyed it. And what's that? Yeah.
Well, we're on the topic of Jewish pride. I just wanted to let everybody know that I went to see a documentary last night called Jews in Baseball. Mm-hmm. And it's directed by the same one of the same guys that works a lot with Ken Burns. It's really well done. And it opens at the Lemley and a couple other theaters around town starting Friday, and I encourage everybody to go.
In fact, even more, encourage you to take your kids. Because it's going to be, right, for like teenage boys especially, you know, who are obsessed with sports. This is a good...
Because they talk about the linkage between Judaism and baseball and how we assimilated it into the American population.
Great.
And it's just so lovely.
Okay, let's do at least a little bit of...
Question?
Yeah, sure.
What percentage of those brilliant minds would you say were Jewish?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Pinker is Jewish.
This is like the game.
Well, actually, none of the people on the other side of our debate were Jewish. Not Dawkins, not Shermer, not Ridley. And obviously I was the only Jew on there because the other one was a Protestant theologian and the other was a Catholic professor here at Biola, in fact.
How many were at the kosher table?
But there were, what's that?
How many were at the kosher table?
Yeah, me. and Amir Axel was also at the kosher table. I would say of the lecturers, maybe 30%, maybe a third, maybe a fifth to a third, because that's so. I'm just thinking offhand. Maybe a little bit less, but Pinker, Axel, Friedman, Schachter, me obviously, and I'm sure several others Nancy Siegel is Jewish. I don't know, that's already six. There were only 30 speakers. Jonah Lehrer, that's seven. So that's just off the top of my head, and I'm sure that a few Jews snuck under the radar, as they always do. Women was smaller. I would say, I think the conference was underrepresented. Women were underrepresented at this conference, although there were more than I mentioned. I don't know. How many? There was a performer, quite remarkable performer, who was, I think, Mexican. There were also, there was a Mexican guy who was, who gave sort of, I thought, a classic sort of socialist talk. It was about how government should work, and it really was like, you know, old line. He was an older guy, and so on. And of course, it came up to me afterwards. He's Jewish.
There's
a lot. So there were not as many women as men. I sat next to a guy whose name escapes me who works in Nigeria and also there were musical performances. And I'll just say one thing about the musical performance was this one guy, again, decided that all these poor kids from Mexico should be taught musical instruments, and he created this choir, and sure enough, there was this like 5 or 6 year old violinist who's a semi-prodigy who came up and he did a solo, and what it strikes you that there's so much. There are so many gifts out there, so many that you could take You know, you could sweep up any barrio in the world and you would find people who have trained. It's like if you weren't at Marilyn Berger's library talk, this book that she wrote about Rick Hodes, who is this incredible tzaddik, who basically treats kids all through Africa. I mean, and not only Africa, but through the third world. Mother Teresa sends her, you know, hopeless cases to him. The only tool he has is a stethoscope. He's cured thousands of kids. He's adopted a bunch of them and so on. And she went to report on him, and she saw this kid who's had a terrible curvature of the spine, who just was in the, he was just in the street. And she brings him to Rick Hodes' clinic, and he said to her, you know, you saved this boy's life, because eventually his spine would have collapsed in on himself, he would have died. She saves him. She's back in America, he's coming to me. She says, you know, why don't you bring him? Bring him to visit, let him see America. I remember him so fondly, so he brings him. She ends up, to make a long story short, she was married to Don Hewitt, who was the producer of 60 Minutes. As he's dying of cancer, she adopts this boy.
She's 74 when she does.
Yeah, she's 74 when she does it. This boy who she found on the street gets tested in the local public school. First, they think his IQ was 150. Then they revise it to 180. Wow. The teacher, the head of the school, says this is the most gifted child I've ever seen in my life. Wow. She found him on the street, in Ethiopia. I mean, there are so many gifts out there. And here, I just want to tell you, and I came up with a theory about why Jews are so smart. I'm serious. I think this is a new theory. It's based on what Jonah Lehrer said. And I'm not kidding about this. Matt Ridley, who was this geneticist who was talking, I guess we're not doing that much Torah today. Matt Ridley is this geneticist who was talking. I prepared good stuff, so come back next time. He was talking about networking. That was what his talk was about. He did the debate, but he also did a talk before, Matt Ridley. And his new book is called, I think, The Rational Optimist. He says the more interconnection there is, the more prosperity, the more ideas, and the more the societies that are more interconnected tend to be more successful. So I was talking to Jonah Lehrer about this. And he said, you know, what we've discovered in neuroscience, in studies, is that, you know, those bull sessions where you're not supposed to criticize. Everybody give your ideas, but nobody criticize. He said they're completely unproductive. Much more productive is when there's interchange. He said, so he gave Pixar as an example. He said every morning in Pixar, they tear apart what they did the day before. He said, and you have to sit there and think. And I said, it's like the Talmud. I said, every time in the Talmud, there's always an argument. There's constantly an argument. And I gave a really beautiful example that I learned from Jonathan Sacks. Jonathan Sacks says, you know when God says to Abraham, when God thinks, am I going to tell Abraham what I'm about to do? And he says, you only do that, you only say, should I tell someone what I'm about to do, if in fact they're going to be upset, right? Otherwise, if they're going to be pleased, then you just tell them. You don't worry if you should tell them, right? I gave this example once before in Talmud class, and then he tells Abraham, and you're inviting an argument, and sure enough, Abraham argues, and Sacks uses that as the basis of the Jewish love of argument. So I said to Jonah, I said, you know, this may be why Jews do so well, because interconnection and argument and community, that's what we do. And it may have less to do with the fact that we're genetically, you know, predisposed to be smart, because unlike priests, rabbis had children, right? That was the intellectual cream of the crop in the Catholic Church, were the priests, and they didn't have children, right? Rabbis were supposed to have children. It may have less to do with that than just with the fact that we've always assumed that you should have this constant interchange argument and so on. And if Matt Ridley's right, the closer the interchange, the more ideas you generate. His line was, Ridley said, better 100 stupid people who talk to each other than 100 smart people who don't. Which I thought was really interesting. What's that?
He said that.
R-I-D-L-E-Y, Matt Ridley. You can find him most easily now in the columns of the Wall Street Journal. But he also has written a bunch of books about genetics and so on. And this was a perfect example of it. That, let's say that idea about Jewish intelligence is correct. Okay, it may not be, but let's say it is. I never would have gotten any inkling of it if I hadn't been at a conference where everybody was arguing and talking with each other. If I sat home alone, I never would have thought of such a thing. And in fact, it is incredibly fruitful to have people have this kind of interchange, because what happened was I talked to Ridley, then I talked to Lehrer, and then it occurred to me, and Ridley gave an example of that. You know the camera pill?
Yes.
So he said, had a gastroenterologist not had a discussion with an expert in, what was it? Yeah, some kind of military camera, whatever, work. He said, had the two of them not talked, you never would have a camera pill. And that interchange across disciplines from different people who believe different things is very fruitful. So, yeah.
I mean, that's the first part of nation. They call it mashup.
Right, mashup, exactly. He talked about that. He talked about it in Israel. That startup nation is exactly that, called mashup. That's what they practice in Israel. They don't do this. This may not surprise you. They don't do this don't criticize stuff in Israel. They do this. They do the other thing, which is called criticize each other savagely. That's what they do in Israel. And it works. And it works. You just have to know that what's being criticized are your ideas. I must say that in the debate, that's where I actually think that Dawkins made a mistake, smart as he is, because he can't restrain his hostility to religion. He truly hates religion in a way that I don't actually think Hitchens does. I mean, Hitchens, when he's hostile, there's a certain good-humoredness about it. With Dawkins, there's a dry wit, but it's not good-humored. It's witty, but it's not good-humored. And he was talking about religious people, and he said that they were childish and they were lazy. He said, whereas scientists roll up their sleeves and go to work. So as soon as I heard that, I was so grateful. And I got up, and then he said, by the way, that I had talked about how, I had talked about how you don't make your basic decisions in life based on scientific principles, whether it's worth getting up in the morning, with whom you fall in love, what your dreams are. I said, you don't evaluate those scientifically. So he said, David Wolpe said something very disagreeable. He said that scientists don't have dreams and don't have love. So again, but I was pleased. When someone says something like that, it's just an so I got up and I said, look, I'd like to say four things that I didn't say. One is I didn't say that scientists don't have love, just that they're not scientifically ascertainable. I didn't say that our opponents were lazy. I didn't say that they were childish. And I didn't say that only we on our side were good-mannered in debate. And then I went on to other things. But you have to always, you have to always remember that especially if you're in a public debate, that if somebody's insulting, that's just an opportunity. And that's why I think that if you can't restrain your contempt for the people you're arguing with, it's not good in a public forum, right? That's why the people who, like Michio Kaku, one of the reasons why he's so successful is he enjoys himself. And you feel he has this when he was talking about the future, he was getting so excited, And that's like that exchange that I had with him where he said, you may not want to, but your kids will. It's a very, it's much more effective. I enjoyed most of the arguments they were making. I mean, they were interesting arguments. It's just the dourness doesn't help. That's why it's a lot harder to argue with someone like Hitchens, because he does have this, brio. So anyway, yeah.
How do you distinguish between the savage criticism that you were talking about in Israel versus the insulting nature of...
Because he was calling us childish and lazy. He didn't say that our arguments were foolish. It has to do with whether you attack the person or the argument. Some of the attacking that they did in the arguments, especially Ridley, they were very hard to answer. But nobody for a second could accuse Ridley of being disagreeable. He was just attacking our arguments. And then Shermer, too, although Shermer's whole, his bearing is very aggressive. Ridley's is not. Ridley is like the English, urbane, elegant, sophisticated arguer. But Shermer's was aggressive in bearing, but that's because you could feel he was upset that people held the views that we hold. Okay, that's all right. And also, because he grew up evangelical, which, can always turn you. But it's true. But Dawkins really hates religion. You can feel it from him. If you turn that into wit, which he does sometimes, that's fine. But when you turn it into, and therefore religious people are stupid and lazy, it's just an ineffective debating, technique. What's that? And it's also rude, right. It's also rude. It only endears you to the people who already completely agree with you. But it has no possibility of actually persuading anyone. And by the way, the audience was fairly evenly divided, because Roemer asked at the beginning how many people think the universe has a purpose and how many don't. And it was pretty to my surprise, because I thought the kind of people who would be attracted to this festival would be anti-religious, because they're coming to see mostly neuroscience, physics. I mean, that there was only one religion debate. All the rest of it was on other topics. But they were actually, I mean, there was a lot of, and the other, I'll tell you one other thing. The first night, I sat across from this guy, Salinas, who, as I told you, he sponsors it. So he brings a bunch of his Grupo Salinas, which is his big company, his biggest company. He brings a lot of his top people to the conference. So sitting across from somebody who, sure enough, turns out to be one of his top people, maybe in this, I don't know, I think they're in the cell phone industry. Anyway, so I'm sitting across from him and from his wife, and we're talking, and where'd you grow up? He grew up in New York. He lived in Brentwood for a while. He's Jewish. His wife is Jewish. He says, but you know, I said, how is it to live in Mexico? Because his wife is Mexican, but he's grew up. The values are so much better. It's so much easier to raise kids in this kind of place. You don't fight the same kind of stuff, and so on and so forth. It's, you know, all of that. Then finally, I say, it sounds great and it sounds wonderful. And I say, well, is it dangerous? She goes, oh yeah, we live behind gated communities. And I thought, you know, you really, it's a trade-off anywhere you go. It really is, because I'm sure it's true that there's a lot of stuff he doesn't have to contend with. On the other hand, you know, he's self-identified as one of Salinas' top people, and not so easy. Not so easy. Yeah.
Do you think that this debate that you had could change anybody's mind over there? Did he ask the people at the end how many now? You know,
I think ask at the end if anybody's mind was changed, which would have been interesting. Here's what I actually think about that. Having gone through a lot of these debates, here's what I think is possible that happens. I think it's rare for the debate to change someone's mind unless they've never thought about the other side. If you've never thought about the other side, if, for example, you grew up completely religious and you never thought about the other side, then an argument can hit you like a blast furnace, you know? By and large not. But then it really can hit you very hard. But what generally happens, I think, is there's an emotional opening when you see someone from the other side who's actually not crazy, not stupid, not mean, and espouses that view, whichever side you're on. So I think that it's important for credible religious people to be seen publicly. And for the other side, it's important for people who are not angry, but someone like Matt Ridley, who you could say, here's somebody that I actually, because when he and I were talking the night before at one of the whatever things that they had, and we were saying, like, we share, out of 100%, we share probably 80% of a worldview. I actually think that people's minds can be open to the possibility that the other side is plausible, but I'm not sure that anybody can be convinced. So, all right.
How did you get invited, and how did the attendees get invited?
I got invited really fairly last minute because they. It's a long series of coincidences that have nothing to do with me, but they wanted to have a rabbi, and they asked Michael Shermer, with whom I had once been on a panel, because they were searching for somebody who does these kinds of debates. They asked Michael Shermer if he knew me. And we did something once for National Public Radio, which wasn't a debate. It was just kind of some joint appearance. And he said, yeah, well, he's okay, you can invite him. So they invited me. But first, that Nadia, who is Andreas Roemer's sister, Nadia Betek. She's the one whose kids were there and who keeps kosher and so on. Um, her son knew also knew who I was because he'd watched some of the debates online. And so that also, those two things together. But we were already talking about what debate they should do next year. So I hope to go back. I don't know what weekend it is, but I really...
Anybody
can attend. And it's not, you know, and they do it very well. They assign one person to every speaker. And that person picks you up at the airport with a driver, and the whole weekend, if there's anything that you need, they're supposed to attend to it. So I asked her, there was a woman who's, you know, she grew up in Puebla, all her kids grew up in Puebla, she has grandchildren in Puebla, and I asked her what the story was, and she said it's actually very expensive to attend, it's almost $500. And I thought, you know, that's probably very expensive. Salinas underwrites a lot of it, but anybody can go. And part of my point in writing the Huffington Post article was to give Roemer more publicity because he's an amazing guy. He's one of these people. He sparks ideas all the time. You know, you see him everywhere at the conference. Everywhere you go, Roemer is there. And he gathers all these people, and he becomes friendly with all of them. And he asks them a question in Spanish. After each presentation, he asks a question or two. He's clearly very bright. And he's read all this stuff, and he just loves this. And you, again, it's one of those infectious, you know, you want to help him. So I wrote the article in part and talked about him and talked about the festival because I want to make it bigger. I want him to get, you know, more and more. And the music was great too, and the children's choir was wonderful, and the variety of things that he talks about AIDS, and he talks about kids and feeding people in Nigeria, as well as these public issues. It's very, you know, it's a wonderful thing. It is a wonderful thing.
Is he trying to compete with the Davos?
Well, he wants it to be a Mexican TED, basically. You know, those lectures that you see online. Yeah, he wants it to be a Mexican, and he is starting to succeed because the people that he's drawing are the same people that go to these other conferences. And so in that sense, he's smart enough to know that the more he invites someone like Pinker and treats him well, the more, it's like, I mean, that when Hitchens was talking about the debate and he goes back and says, you know, I was in Mexico and it was a good experience, the people that he knows and talks to just in the course of his normal day, you know, are going to be, yes. The one thing that I did see, with the exception of... Pisani's talk about AIDS, and I didn't hear all the talks. I missed some of them. First of all, because I came Thursday night and the thing started Thursday morning, but also because I missed some on Saturday afternoon because of the Mincha and the Sudash Lishit and so on. But they were extraordinarily optimistic. You know, Pinker talked about how violence is actually declining in the world, even though you might not think so when you really look at the statistics. And Ridley was talking about how the world is increasingly interconnected. And science and technology, they're all sort of boosters of science and technology. And Pinker afterwards, it was very interesting. So Amir Axel came up to me and said, one of the things that Pinker said was, even if you compare the most violent countries in the 20th century, even if you look at Germany and you look at Austria, and then you look at Japan, and you look at the countries in the Middle Ages who were violent, the percentage of people who died in those countries was much greater than the percentage. So Amir Axel was very upset about this. He said, anything that minimizes the Holocaust to me is just in my gut. I can't, you know, look, he understands statistics. He's a professor of mathematics, but he doesn't. So afterwards, I came up to Pinker, whom I've known for a while, and actually I had a debate with at Harvard, and he's a wonderful guy, and I wrote a positive review of his wife's novel. So now we're, you know. Right, exactly, that's right. So I said to him, you know, I just want to give you a heads up if you see Amir that he's upset just on an emotional level, not that he's arguing with your argument, but just on an emotional level because he says, I know he spoke to me. He said, you know, it's interesting. There are two groups of people that are upset about this. He said, one are Jews, which I understand. I mean, he's Jewish and he's like identified Jewish. Our debate was in the Harvard Hillel. I mean, he's Jewish. His wife, Rebecca Goldstein, grew up Orthodox there. He said, and the second group are Germans. He said, Germans also, when I was in Germany presenting this talk, he said the Germans did not like the idea that anything could be seen to minimize the horrendousness of the Holocaust. Because they've all been raised to think it's the worst thing that ever happened. And if you tell them it's not the worst thing that ever happened, they get very upset. Which was a fascinating, and look, Angela grew up in Germany and she's shaking her head, yes, it was a fascinating thing to hear. I never would have expected it, you know? What's that?
You think it'd be more relief.
You're right, you would think it would be a relief, but that was not how they felt about it at all. My guess is in Austria they would say it was a relief. But there was a tremendous amount of optimism which made me a little bit uncomfortable. Because really the idea that science is going to solve all our problems, I just, you know, there's a part of me that thinks we're headed for a fall. I feel the human hubris in this. Like, you know, we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to extend the lifespan way beyond. And Michio Kaku was talking about, you know, someone's going to, like they do in Star Trek, someone's going to basically wave a thing around you and three times a year that will be your checkup and they'll see medical problems coming from a mile away and, you know, you'll live to some absurdly old age and everything will be great. And I don't know. Yes.
You just said something very interesting. Science is going to solve all our problems.
Right.
All our problems are not science.
I know.
A lot of our problems are spiritual.
I agree with you,
and
but
so
they don't.
There should be a balance, I think.
But that's not, you know, that's not how the neuroscientists, some of them at least, feel about it. What can I tell you? We'll take a whole group next year. I have to find out when it is. What's that? Yeah, we'll go to APAC and we'll go to the Mexican Ideas Conference. Right? I don't know. It was such an interesting. Yeah, exactly. That's right. We'll announce at the end the largest congregation of any group to the Mexican Conference of Ideas.
It started with the missions. Why not?
Yeah, why not? Why not? And what's that? And then the other day, I'll tell you somewhere else we need to go. Do you know, Anne Heyman came to my office. I don't know if you know who, some of you know who she is. And she built the first, it's remarkable what she did. She, you know, the youth villages in Israel that are specifically designed to deal with orphans because they had such a huge orphan problem, especially after the Second World War. So she used that model to build the first youth village in Rwanda, where there is the largest orphan problems in history after the Rwandan genocide. There are millions of kids, literally millions of kids without mothers or fathers. So she built the first youth village and she wants to do an interfaith mission. She wants to see if she can get Rick Warren, who's taken many trips to Rwanda, and our synagogue to go to Rwanda to the youth village. So we have to go to the youth village in Rwanda, to the Mexican Festival of Ideas, and also at the same time not miss anybody's bar bat mitzvah. That's what we have to do.
Wedding,
and God forbid anyone should pass away. It's just hard, you know, it's hard, yeah. Sean?
It seems amazing to go to Mexico, but it just dawns on me, I think there's such exceptional talent in the synagogue.
You want to do a festival of ideas in Los Angeles? All you need to do is find a Jewish Ricardo Salinas and we're in business. I just want to say, if you got a sufficiently gifted organizer and a sufficient donor, you absolutely could. Those are the two things you need. But I want you to know they planned this festival for a year. One of his assistants was escorting me Saturday night to the car that was taking me back to the hotel. And I said to her, so what do you do other than the festival? She said, I don't do anything other than the festival. She said, tomorrow I'm starting to plan next year's festival. So it's a lot of work to bring you, look, all, among other things, just before I get to Norm, and by the way, I hope you're all gonna be at the Masoreti dinner honoring Norm Pell as our Masoreti honoree. And that's where you get the last question, but I just wanna say, not only all the guests, but if you think that all 30 speakers aren't prima donnas and they don't all expect their, you know, and they, some of them brought their families and they all want certain accommodations. And I walked into the hotel room and there's a huge bottle of tequila like in the middle of the room, first of all. And there's books and candy and a bag. And I mean, you know, they want the speakers to go back and say what I'm saying, which is this was an amazing conference. And that takes a lot of work because most of these people, don't have congregations. Most of them go to many conferences. They live on planes. And so if they're going to remember this one and tell people that this one's really good, it's going to take, yeah, Norm. Ah, thank you. A beautiful note on which to end. So that was Torah study, and next week is Thanksgiving, so we resume in 2 weeks with the beginning of the Joseph story again. All right, thanks a lot. Joseph, no.